From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, ET Intelligence. Here's what's happening. Tragedy in New Jersey. A New Jersey police officer who was among six people killed in a shootout that brought the streets of Jersey City to a standstill had been credited with having led the department in the number of illegal guns removed from the streets in recent years. Detective Joseph Seals, 40 years old, was among six people, including three bystanders and two of the three suspects who opened fire on police and civilians, killed Tuesday. Very tragic story. Authorities said the shootout might have been started by Seals trying to stop an incident involving illegal guns when he was shot down by gunfire that erupted initially near a cemetery. Nearly 175 Saudi Arabian military aviation students have been grounded as part of a safety stand down here in the United States after a Saudi Air Force lieutenant shot and killed three people last week at a U.S. Navy base in Florida. House Democrats have announced that they will vote on whether to impeach President Donald Trump on two specific articles, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, next week. Judiciary Chairperson Gerald Nadler, flanked by House Representative Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the chairs of four other panels involved in the impeachment inquiry, made the announcement charging the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, with committing high crimes and misdemeanors. If the vote is successful, it will then go to the Senate for a trial. And then, of course, that's a full-scale investigation. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us here. John, update us on the latest, would you, sir?
I'd be happy to, George. I mean, what's really happened today is the inevitable, which we all knew that they were, you know, that the deck was stacked against Trump and they were going to smear him any way they could. So the articles of impeachment, you'll notice the two articles, abuse of power and the obstruction of Congress, are two of the conditions that are not considered high crimes or misdemeanors at all. They're, the U.S. Constitution specifies what they would be. The abuse of power could not be a more ambiguous and certainly vague statute. Obstruction of Congress has to do with, you know, the resistance on the part of the administration to allow certain individuals, you know, to testify before the committee. But that had to do with Article 1 and Article 2 authority. President Trump has every right to maintain the confidence of, you know, his employees working for him. And yet the Congress, under, you know, Article 1, believes that they can engage in the most abusive use of the U.S. Constitution by reinventing, boldly making up their own definitions of impeachable offenses. It's bad enough that they conducted, you know, several weeks of closed-door hearings, not allowing any cross-examination of the witnesses, basically engaged in a star chamber, a kangaroo court, in order to arrive at this stage right now, which is no surprise to anybody that they voted in these articles of impeachment. But when you think about how this will end in maybe one of the quickest trials in history, it may not. I mean, if it goes to trial, which it looks like it might in January, it's not going to last very long. And even if it does, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, if this really is a serious trial, and the Republican attorneys representing Trump, defending him, called Joe Biden, his son, and Adam Schiff as witnesses, all of whom refused to testify for various reasons. What a complete farce this is. And remember that Gerald Nadler, about a year ago, said that when they asked him, well, are you going to impeach, you know, the president? You know, he was saying, well, we have to have certain criteria present before we do this. And one of the criteria, yes, one of the criteria is we have to have a consensus. We have to have some bipartisan support. There's not one Republican that is supporting this sham impeachment right now. And what does that tell you? It tells you basically that you have to essentially regard every Republican in the House Judiciary Committee as totally politically corrupt, because they don't go along with this partisan, one-sided impeachment proceeding by the Democrats. I mean, so where this stands right now is this is heading for a major train wreck for the Democrats in the U.S. Senate. This will go down in a blaze of glory. And then today, to preempt this, Representative Al Green from Texas, who's one of the most hateful partisans against Trump, said that, well, this is just the beginning. If the impeachment fails this time, we'll impeach him again on other charges.
Jeez, it's got to stop, John, because we're not running the country. Go ahead, wrap it up.
It's all a foredrawn conclusion. You know, it will fail in the U.S. Senate. And, you know, hopefully we can get back to some business as usual.
I'm amazed that we're governing this country with all this stuff that's going on. John, thanks so much. Dr. John Curtis, of course, he supports President Trump. You hear from Howard Bloom from time to time. He does not, so you get a couple different views. A federal judge in Texas has blocked the Trump administration from using $3.6 billion earmarked for the military to fund part of the border wall construction. They said no. The CDC is warning you about a multi-state outbreak of E. coli infections linked to Fresh Express Sunflower Crisp Chopped Salad Kits. As of December 9th, 8 people from 3 states were infected with the strain identified in the outbreak, according to the CDC. 3 were hospitalized, including one person who developed kidney failure. No deaths reported there. White Castle has issued a voluntary recall of multiple products for possible listeria contamination. The recall affects a limited number of frozen 6-pack cheeseburgers, frozen 6-pack hamburgers, frozen 6-pack jalapeno cheeseburgers, 16-pack hamburgers, and 16-pack cheeseburgers, according to the Food and Drug Administration. My gosh. Explorers and scientists are on the trail of the legendary creature of Bigfoot in the forests of Oregon. They say they may have captured video footage of the beast in an area where thousands of Bigfoot sightings have been reported. The ape-like Bigfoot creature is thought to be real by lots of people. In a moment, Dr. Thomas Cohen joins us with his latest work. He's got 3 separate books out, Cancer and the New Biology of Water, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness, and Human Heart, Cosmic Heart. And we're going to talk about all of these with Dr. Tom next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Dr. Thomas Cohen. Dr. Cohen, MD, has studied and written about many subjects in medicine, including nutrition, homeopathy, and herbal medicine as well. He is the co-founder of a couple family businesses, Dr. Cohen's Garden, which focuses on his love of food and gardening, and the Human Heart, Cosmic Heart, which provides interesting and other natural medicines to a wider audience. I just mentioned his books. We'll give you the titles again in a moment. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And Tom, I understand first time on the program. Is that true?
That's true. And thank you for having me on your show.
Well, likewise. We finally found you, huh?
I guess so.
Well, so what is new with you these days, sir?
What's new is just doing my practice and doing a lot of talking about the latest book that came out, which seems to have kind of struck a chord with people.
I think so, too. Tell us, first of all, your definition, if you could, doctor, on cancer. What exactly is that?
That's a good question. Cancer is when there's basically, if you talk about tumors, I talked about in the book, there's 2 hallmarks of tumors. One is that the tumor cells, the cells that make up a tumor, are more dense. The density of the cells is higher than the rest of the tissue. So in other words, if you're feeling like a breast, which is an easy place to feel, you feel a normal texture of the tissue. And then you come to the tumor, and it feels like a hard rock. And the reason it feels like a hard rock is because there's an increased density of the cells in that space. So that's one definition. The other definition is all cancers have an abnormal number of chromosomes. It's called aneuploidy. And that's the way that the pathologists identify under a microscope that there's something amiss about this cell because it doesn't have the human number of chromosomes any longer. It has an abnormal number. So those are the two most basic, and I would also say observable, definitions of cancer.
And even though there's cells that kind of go really crazy, how does it end up killing you? What does it do, actually? Does it hit the key organs and shut you down that way? What happens?
What happens is, and this is called the Warburg phenomena, all cancer cells have had a shift in the way that they essentially generate energy. Most cells generate energy through something called oxidative phosphorylation, otherwise known as respiration, which happens in the mitochondria. You take oxygen, you mix it with glucose, and you make 36 ATPs, which is sometimes called the energy molecule, although that's a misconception. Cancer cells have this a defect in their mitochondria, so they only generate 2 ATPs per glucose. Therefore, it's sort of like if you have a job that pays $36 an hour, and then suddenly they give you a job that pays $2 an hour, you have to work 18 times harder.
Mm-hmm.
So cancer cells have to work, they have to get 18 times as much sugar, which is how we find them on PET scans. And so they first eat all the food you're eating, and then they turn your fat into glucose and eat that, and so then you lose weight. And then when they're done with the fat, they eat your muscle. They turn your muscle protein into glucose, and then they eat that. And then they turn your organ protein into glucose, and then they eat that, and then you die.
Your title to this book is intriguing, Cancer and the New Biology of Water. What's the correlation between cancer and water?
Well, that's starting a few steps down the road. And the reason I say that is because when Nixon announced the war on cancer in 1971, he did so because we thought at the time, and we announced at the time, we meaning the medical profession, that we had found the cause of cancer, which was oncogenes, or mutations in genes that cause cancer. The genes lie in the nucleus of the cell. And so he said, we're going to spend whatever money we need in order to figure this out and to treat cancer. And the prediction was in 10 years, we would eliminate cancer from the United States. At the time, about 1 in 6 Americans got cancer. And there was about 150 or so thousand deaths per year. So here we are 40-some years later, and now approximately 1 out of 2 Americans get cancer, and there's approximately 550,000 deaths per year from cancer. So it's safe to say Nixon's prediction or the prediction of the medical establishment was wrong. In the book, what I point out is there's a very clear reason why this trillion-dollar effort, probably the biggest effort humans have ever been engaged in to find the cause and the treatment of cancer, has basically failed. And the predominant reason is because essentially we bet the farm that the cause of cancer was in the nucleus, was in a defective genes or mutated genes, which caused products which then caused cancer. There's a very simple experiment which was done, which was they took a normal cell and a cancer cell, and they transplant the nucleus from the normal cell into the cytoplasm, which is the watery part of a cancer cell, and the progeny were cancerous. And then they did the reverse, so they took the nucleus out of a cancer cell and put it into a healthy cytoplasm, which is the watery part of the cell, and the progeny were normal. And what that tells you is that the location of the cancer is in the cytoplasm, which is the watery part, not in the nucleus, which is where the genes are. And so this trillion-dollar venture, the whole biotech industry, studying the effect of the genes, was the analogy that I said in the book. It was like you go upon it, you find a guy who's looking for something under a street light, and you say, what are you looking for? And he says, my keys. And then you say, well, where did you lose them? And he says, in the bushes over there. And then you say, well, why are you looking under the light if you lost them in the bushes? And he says, because the light's better. The problem of cancer is in the cytoplasm, in the watery part, not in the nucleus. And because we've only looked in the nucleus, we haven't found the key, and therefore we have more cancer and a failure to treat it. So when I say cancer and the new biology of water, I'm talking about what is a cytoplasm, what is this watery part, how is it made, and how does it directly cause cancer?
Now, is this the gel type that you talk about?
Right. If you look at a cell, it's essentially a circle, and then it has a cytoplasm where it's essentially a watery part, and then it has a nucleus. And so we're not talking about the nucleus because that's not the source of the cancer. You can prove that with these studies, which, by the way, the references are all in my book. So then you have to answer the question of what is the watery part of the cytoplasm and how could that possibly cause cancer? So the first thing one has to realize, you know, I was taught in medical school and I, you know, a normally trained doctor, that the cytoplasm is 70% water, and you have all these things dissolved in the water, like mitochondria and Golgi apparatus and ribosomes. And the water is all in a liquid state, because after all, we were taught that matter can only exist in three states, solid, liquid, or gas. So if you're talking about water, you're talking about ice, water, and steam. And so 70% of the contents of the cell are water. And if you ask the question, what form is it in or what phase, they told me it was liquid. So when I was an ER doctor, I used to see people shot and bayoneted and stabbed and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And to my surprise, nobody squirted water out of their leg. And I started to wonder over the years, so where's all the water? And it turns out that there is no liquid water in the cells. This whole conception we have of biology, of stuff floating around in water in the cells, is basically wrong. And it's wrong because it turns out there's a fourth state of water, which doesn't really have a formal name, but it's a gel phase, or sometimes people call it structured water or coherent water.
Is it changed to that? Does the body change it to that?
The body creates water through metabolism, or you drink water, and then just like Jell-O, which is a kind of structured water, Jell-O is formed by the mixture of proteins, hydrophilic proteins. Hydrophilic means proteins that interact with water, and then you put water in the system, and then you heat it, and that unfolds the proteins. That allows them to interact with water, and then when they cool, they form gels. And something very similar happens in the cytoplasm. We have proteins, that we have water that's generated by metabolism or the water you drink. We make ATP in the mitochondria from glucose and fats. The ATP binds with the proteins and unfolds them. That allows them to interact with water, and that forms the gel.
Now, how do we recognize that in order to create more of it in our body, which I assume would fight off cancer?
Well, the first thing I would say is this, quote, theory that I have that an abnormality of the gels is the direct cause of the cancer is actually what I would call settled science. And the reason I say that is because we have a diagnostic technique to find cancer, which is called an MRI. So you do an MRI of your liver, and if there's an area that has increased, you know, it looks darker than the rest, mm-hmm. the radiologists say that's cancer. So if you ask it, most doctors, so what is an MRI measuring? They actually don't know. In fact, I didn't know for years either. And then I found out that an MRI measures the degree of coherence or how structured the water is in the cell.
Hold on for a second, Tom. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about your work, cancer, and the new biology of water. Then I want to get into your research on vaccines and also the human heart. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. We're with Dr. Thomas Cullen, and we're talking about his latest work, cancer, and the new biology of water. We'll get into vaccines and the human heart a little bit later on in the program as well. Thomas, back to this so-called gel. So if we understand it, what is science saying about this right now?
Science mostly tries to ignore it because they basically don't understand it and don't get the significance.
If they could, they'd sure be able to make some inroads into fighting cancer, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and like I say, you know, the MRI basically proves that, again, to say it very simply, the MRI is measuring the coherence or the structure of water. When they see the structure of water deteriorate, that shows up as a cancer. Now, why that doesn't lead conventional oncology and science to say, I wonder what the conditions are that lead to structured water in the cell or lead to the destruction of structured water, I don't know. But it's very clear that's what the problem is. And I think, as I pointed out in the book, the imperative is to try to understand, you know, how the water gets structured, what are the components, and what leads to the destruction of water, of the gel in the water, in the cytoplasm, which is basically the, you know, that's the whole shebang.
Now, you talk about a six-point program. Talk to us about that, Tom.
You know, the main thing here is to get into, you know, what structures the water. I think before the programs, and it's just to get the basic concept. And so the way that I try to explain this is to ask your listeners to picture the following. So picture a beaker of water, and then you suspend a horizontal hydrophilic tube in that water. Now, whenever there's a horizontal, whenever there's a hydrophilic tube in water, it will tend to form a gel on the lining of the tube. And this is very measurable. You can measure the pH changes in the gel as compared to the liquid water. And you can also measure the voltage. And the reason you can measure the voltage is because all of these gels are negatively charged. And because they collect electrons in the gel, they also push the protons, the positive charges, into the water. So if you can picture this, you have a tube that's negatively charged with positive protons in the middle, and the positive protons, they repel each other, and they start the water in the tube flowing. So you can measure the strength of the gel. And the strength of the gel, like I said, determines the voltage of the cell. It determines whether the cell is alive. And you can see what things influence the movement of the water. You can see what things increase or decrease voltage. And essentially, my whole therapeutic program, it essentially comes out of that. So, for instance, you take this beaker of water with the tube in it, and you put it in a lead box, and the flow stops. Because there needs to be an energy source from the outside that essentially charges up the gels. So you take it out of the lead box, and you shine it in the sun. You shine the sun on it, and the flow will start, which means that the energy of the sun can be an effective energy source for the charging of your gels. And then you put that the beaker on the earth, and the electromagnetic field from the earth also charges the water, charges, it creates the gel and creates flow. You can also put your hands on it, and there's an electromagnetic field from our hands, which donates energy, donates electrons into the system, into the water. The water is a receptor for all this, and that creates flow. And then, interestingly, you put your cell phone next to it, and the cell phone, the radiation from an electromagnetic field from a cell phone, a wireless device, stops the flow and destructures the gel. It inhibits the formation of voltage, which is how nerves function and how cells charge themselves to create their distance so they don't clump together to form tumors. And you can see that there's a whole lot of factors in our environment that end up destructuring the water, and there's a whole lot of factors that end up structuring the water. And the more you do the factors that structure the water, the less cancer you'll get, and the more voltage you'll have, the more energy you'll have, the more nerve function you'll have. That's also the way that the blood flows in the body, because we have capillaries that have that are hydrophilic, and they have water in the form of blood in it. They create essentially a charge, and the protons in the water, the positive charges, repel each other and create flow in the blood. So this is the basis of life that I'm talking about, which unfortunately is not very recognized in modern biology or medicine.
Now, with your program, of course, if you stick to it, what are the odds of never getting cancer?
I have no idea, because because that's never been done, and that would be a wild guess. But I can tell you that as we go on, we're all exposed more and more to these, you know, influences, particularly wireless radiation is one.
Sure.
Toxins in the environment, toxins that come through vaccines. We know that aluminum destructures your water. In fact, you can see the whole fever response, you know, because the way I think of it is something like, I always ask myself the question, what would I do if I was this body? So what I'm saying is that the gel phase in your cytoplasm, that creates the charge, that creates the distance between cells so they don't clump together. That actually, we know from research that the gel water in around the DNA actually tells the DNA how to express itself. So the gel phase water goes right down into the expression of the DNA. This is the basis of life. So the reason I got into the childhood illness too is, you say, so what would happen if somebody dissolved some poison in your gel? And if you want to think about this, it would be like dissolving a bad grape in your Jell-O. And so you have to get the bad grape out of your Jell-O. So what would you do? You would heat up the Jell-O, you would make it run, and then once you eliminated the bad grape, you would reconstitute a more healthy gel, a more healthy Jell-O. So that's exactly what humans do when they get sick. They have poisons dissolved in their cell, you know, toxins. They have to get rid of it in order to have this, you know, energetic state that's called health. So they create a fever that heats up the gel runs, that's called mucus, we eliminate the mucus, and then we reconstitute and, you know, recover our health. So that's exactly what we see with acute illness. And that also tells you why that hyperthermia, or, you know, heating the body, is an effective cancer medicine. What does it do? It heats the gels run, they detoxify, they reconstitute in a better form, and then you're overall better. So you can start to see that actually, you know, the history of sweat lodges and the history of fever therapy and Hippocrates saying, give me a medicine to create a fever and I can cure any disease. Suddenly, through this lens, it all starts to make sense.
Would you be considered a rebel doctor now among your peers?
I would think you would have to ask them, but I certainly have views of health and medicine that are not in the mainstream.
Not conventional, but you know what? A lot of people, not medical people, but a lot of people probably would agree with you.
I think there's thousands and maybe millions.
Let's talk a little bit about your other work, and then we'll circle back to some of this. Vaccines, autoimmunity, it's probably one of the most controversial areas for parents, Tom, and that's whether to vaccine their children or not. A lot of people have heard the dangers of vaccines and the possibility they could create autism. Tough decision for a parent to make. Tell me about your thoughts.
So the basic thought, the thing that never comes up in conversation, which is why I take this conversation to a different place, is what does it mean to have an immune system? And the first thing I tell my patients is we don't have an immune system. We have two immune systems. And in order for you to understand vaccines and whether to vaccinate or not, you have to understand this. So here's the way it works. Let's take an example like chickenpox. So this is a virus, and let's say you're a child and you've never encountered it before. So you encounter the virus, it gets into the cytoplasm of your cells, this watery part. Your body can't tolerate distorted cytoplasm because that's basically the foundation of life. So it makes a cell-mediated response to eliminate these infected cells. Now, the important point to realize here is that a cell-mediated response, and it's so called because it's based on the white blood cells, the job is to digest and eliminate those infected cells. And the important point of that is that which we call being sick, meaning fever, rash, mucus, cough, etc., that's because of the activity of the cell-mediated immune system. It's not the virus. It's the virus stimulates a cell-mediated response. And I know that because if you inhibit the cell-mediated response, you can kill the person, but they'll never be, quote, sick. So that cell-mediated response happens for about 7 to 10 days. You've now cleared the virus, and you reconstitute normal cells. Then, because you don't want to go through chickenpox, you know, every month for the rest of your life, you call on the second arm of your immune system called the antibody or humoral immune system, and that part makes antibodies to one of the pieces of chickenpox so that if you ever encounter it again, you will not get sick from chickenpox because you'll never need to use your cell-mediated immune system. The important point of that is there are no symptoms when you have a humoral response. You don't feel sick or anything. So that is how humans interacted with pathogens for, you know, millennia. Mm-hmm. You have these two arms. First you get sick, that clears the virus, then you remember what happened. And that's always the way it worked, and when that happens, you have immunity for life. That's until vaccines. The whole purpose of a vaccine is to bypass the cell-mediated part, because that's the part that, quote, makes you sick,
right,
and only make you make antibodies. There's two things to say about that. The first is you will never have lifelong immunity by only stimulating antibodies. That's proven by the fact that we need boosters. And the second thing is if you continue with a strategy of essentially upregulating or stimulating your antibody response and continually downregulating your cell-mediated response, the only expected outcome you'll have is you'll have an overstimulated humoral antibody response. Now, if you say, what is the definition of an autoimmune disease? The definition is somebody with too many antibodies. What is asthma? That's somebody with an overactive antibody response. What are allergies, food allergies, environmental allergies? That's somebody with an overactive antibody response. We know that autism and neurodevelopmental problems are people who have overactive inflammatory responses based on the activity of antibodies in their nervous system. So the obvious question here is how come we have 150 million people in the United States with too many antibodies? And without trying to be a smart aleck about it, I would say that was the whole point of the vaccine program. It worked.
And it worked, and it was commendable at the time, wasn't it?
It was what?
Was it commendable at the time when they thought it was going to help?
No. No.
Tell me why.
I'll tell you exactly why. So if you go to the most cited paper in vaccine history about how well did vaccines work, it's a paper published in the Journal of the AMA 2007 by a guy who was a senior scientist at the CDC named Rausch. So the paper is called Rausch et al. And that's, again, the most cited paper in the history of vaccines. He said, for instance, that as in the pre- and post-vaccine era, just take one example, the death rate from measles went down 97%, which sounds great, you know.
It does,
pre-
and sure.
Measles, 97%. Now, if you go and read the paper, which most doctors probably didn't, but I did, what you found, and I'll simplify the numbers a little bit, in 1920, the death rate from measles was 100 per 100,000. In 1960, it was 3 per 100,000. So that's a 97% decline. The hitch of the story is the vaccine was introduced in 1963. That's 2 years, 3 years after the death rate
after the decline
had dropped to 3%. And then it continued at around 2% for the next decade or so.
What caused the drop without the vaccine?
So that's a good question. But before I answer that, I'm just going to point out, Rausch is technically correct. If you look at 1965 compared to 1920, there was a pre- and post-vaccine drop of 97%. However, 99% of that drop happened before there was vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same, and I guarantee if you look at the research, you can back me up on this. It's the same for diphtheria. It's the same for whooping cough. It's the same for all the vaccinatable diseases. They all come from that study. All of them, the death rate dropped before the vaccine was introduced dramatically. So the answer to your question, so what happened? Let me just say it like this. I don't know. And why don't I know? Because nobody bothered to investigate it.
But obviously something happened, and it was dramatic.
Right. Maybe it was it was the population got used to the virus. Maybe it was because we realized that if you give children vitamin A, they almost never die of any viral illness. Maybe it was because we stopped pooping in the streets. Maybe it's because we stopped having children drink milk from swill cattle in New York City, which were fed on basically, you know, brewery waste. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why. But the interesting thing about this debate is that would be a very interesting and fruitful study to see what actually happened.
Oh, my God, that would be amazing.
Right. Why don't they do it? They say that it's with the vaccines, even though the CDC evidence of this, if you look at the chart, the drop was 97% before 2 years before there was even a vaccine.
And your numbers don't lie.
And the numbers don't lie. And they're not my numbers, and they're not some, you know, these are from the official studies by the CDC published in JAMA. So, you know, I always say to people, so let's say I don't know, even though it's very interesting and I would love to know, but that doesn't change the facts. The facts is that's not why it reduced. And anybody who disputes that, I would love to see the numbers, because I can guarantee there are no numbers out there.
All right, we're going to come back in a moment, Tom, and talk about your other book, Human Heart, and then we'll take phone calls next hour here on Coast to Coast. We'll tell you where you can get his books. They are all amazing, amazing books on these various subjects. But let's take your calls as well when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.